Words are important. Words are important. Write it three times. Number two, for 1 week, keep a written record of all the words of affirmation you give your spouse each day. On Monday, I said, "You did a great job on this meal. You really look nice in that outfit. I appreciate your picking up the dry cleaning." On Tuesday, I said, and each day, record what you've said. You might be surprised how well or how poorly you're speaking words of affirmation. Number three, set a goal to give your spouse a different compliment each day for 1 month. If an apple a day keeps the doctor away, maybe a compliment a day will keep the counselor away. You may want to record these compliments also, so you will not duplicate the statements. Number four, as you watch TV, read, or listen to people's conversations, look for words of affirmation that people use. Write those affirming statements in a notebook or keep them electronically. Read through these periodically and select those you could use with your spouse. When you use one, note the date on which you used it. Your notebook may become your love book. Remember, words are important. Number five, write a love letter, a love paragraph, or a love sentence to your spouse and give it quietly or with fanfare. You may someday find your love letter tucked away in some special place. Words are important. Number six, compliment your spouse in the presence of his parents or friends. You'll get double credit. Your spouse will feel loved, and the parents will feel lucky to have such a great son-in-law or daughter-in-law. Number seven, look for your spouse's strengths and tell her how much you appreciate those strengths. Chances are she will work hard to live up to her reputation. Number eight, tell your children how great their mother or father is. Do this behind your spouse's back and in her presence. Chapter 5, Love Language Number 2, Quality Time. I should have picked up on Betty Jo's primary love language from the beginning. What was she saying on that spring day when I visited her and Bill in Little Rock? "Bill is a good provider, but he doesn't spend any time with me. What good are all our things if we don't ever enjoy them together?" What was her desire? Quality time with Bill. She wanted his attention. She wanted him to focus on her, to give her time, to do things with her. By quality time, I mean giving someone your undivided attention. I don't mean sitting on the couch watching television together. When you spend your time that way, ABC or NBC has your attention, not your spouse. What I mean is sitting on the couch with the TV off, looking at each other and talking, giving each other your undivided attention. It means taking a walk, just the two of you, or going out to eat and looking at each other and talking. Have you ever noticed that in a restaurant, you can almost always tell the difference between a dating couple and a married couple? Dating couples will look at each other and talk. Married couples sit there and gaze around the restaurant. You'd think they went there to eat. When I sit with my wife and give her 20 minutes of my undivided attention, and she does the same for me, we are giving each other 20 minutes of life. We will never have those 20 minutes again. We are giving our lives to each other. It is a powerful emotional communicator of love. One medicine cannot cure all diseases. In my advice to Bill and Betty Jo, I had made a serious mistake. I assumed that words of affirmation would mean as much to Betty Jo as they would to Bill. I had hoped that if each of them would give adequate verbal affirmation, the emotional climate would change and both of them would begin to feel loved. It worked for Bill. He began to feel more positive about Betty Jo. He began to sense genuine appreciation for his hard work. But it had not worked as well with Betty Jo, for words of affirmation was not her primary love language. Her love language was quality time. I got back on the phone and thanked Bill for his efforts in the past 2 months. I told him that he had done a good job of verbally affirming Betty Jo and that she had heard his affirmations. "But Dr. Chapman," he said, "she's still not very happy. I don't think things are much better for her." "You are right," I said, "and I think I know why. The problem is that I suggested the wrong love language." Bill hadn't the foggiest idea what I meant. I explained that what makes one person feel loved emotionally is not always the thing that makes another person feel loved emotionally. He agreed that his language was words of affirmation. He told me how much that had meant to him as a boy and how good he felt when Betty Jo expressed appreciation for the things he did. I explained that Betty Jo's language was not words of affirmation, but quality time. I explained the concept of giving someone your undivided attention. Not talking to her while you read the newspaper or watch television, but looking into her eyes, giving her your full attention, doing something with her that she enjoys doing, and doing it wholeheartedly. Like going to the symphony with her, he said. I could tell the lights were coming on in Little Rock. Dr. Chapman, that is what she has always complained about. I didn't do things with her. I didn't spend any time with her. We used to go places and do things before we were married, she said, but now you're too busy. That's her love language, all right, no question about it. But what am I going to do? My job is so demanding. Tell me about it, I said. For the next 10 minutes, he gave me the history of his climb up the organizational ladder, of how hard he had worked and how proud he was of his accomplishments. He told me of his dreams for the future and that he knew that within the next 5 years he would be where he wanted to be. Do you want to be there alone, or do you want to be there with Betty Jo and the children, I asked. I want her to be with me, Dr. Chapman. I want her to enjoy it with me. That's why it has always hurt so much when she criticizes me for spending time on the job. I'm doing it for us. I want her to be a part of it, but she's always so negative. Are you beginning to see why she's so negative? I ask. Her love language is quality time. You have given her so little time that her love tank is empty. She doesn't feel secure in your love. Therefore, she is lashed out at what was taking your time, in her mind, your job. She doesn't really hate your job. She hates the fact that she feels so little love coming from you. There's only one answer, Bill, and it's costly. You have to make time for Betty Jo. You have to love her in the right love language. I know you're right, Dr. Chapman. Where do I begin? Do you have a legal pad handy? The one on which we made the list of the positive things about Betty Jo? It's right here. Good. We're going to make another list. What are some things that you know Betty Jo would like you to do with her? Things she has mentioned through the years. Here is Bill's list. Spend weekends in the mountains, sometimes with the children and sometimes just the two of us. Meet her for lunch at a nice restaurant, or sometimes even at McDonald's. Get a babysitter and take her out to dinner, just the two of us. When I come home at night, sit down and talk with her about my day and listen as she tells me about her day. She doesn't want me to watch TV while we're trying to talk. Spend time talking with the children about their school experiences. Spend time playing games with the children. Go on a picnic with her and the children on Saturday and don't complain about the ants and the flies. Take a vacation with the family at least once a year. Go walking with her and talk as we walk. Those are the things she's talked about through the years, he said. You know what I'm going to suggest, don't you, Bill? Do them, he said. That's right. One a week for the next 2 months. Where will you find the time? You will make it. You are a wise man, I continued. You would not be where you are if you were not a good decision maker. You have the ability to plan your life and to include Betty Jo in your plans. I know, he said. I can do it. And, Bill, this does not have to diminish your vocational goals. It just means that when you get to the top, Betty Jo and the children will be with you. That's what I want more than anything. Whether I'm at the top or not, I want her to be happy, and I want to enjoy life with her and the children. The years have come and gone. Bill and Betty Jo have gone to the top and back. But the important thing is that they've done it together. The children have left the nest. Bill and Betty Jo agree that these are their best years ever. Bill has become an avid symphony fan. Betty Jo has made an unending list in her legal pad of things she appreciates about Bill. He never tires of hearing them. He has now started his own company and is near the top again. His job is no longer a threat to Betty Jo. She is excited about it and encourages him. She knows that she is number one in his life. Her love tank is full, and if it begins to get empty, she knows that a simple request on her part will get Bill's undivided attention. Focused attention. It isn't enough to just be in the same room with someone. A key ingredient in giving your spouse quality time is giving them focused attention, especially in this era of many distractions. When a father is sitting on the floor rolling a ball to his 2-year-old, his attention is not focused on the ball, but on the child. For that brief moment, however long it lasts, they are together. If, however, the father is talking on the phone while he rolls the ball, his attention is diluted. Some husbands and wives think they're spending time together, when in reality, they are only living in close proximity. They are in the same house at the same time, but they are not together. A wife who is texting while her husband tries to talk to her is not giving him quality time, because he does not have her full attention. Quality time does not mean that we have to spend our together moments gazing into each other's eyes. It means that we are doing something together and that we are giving our full attention to the other person. The activity in which we are both engaged is incidental. The important thing, emotionally, is that we are spending focused time with each other. The activity is a vehicle that creates the sense of togetherness. The important thing about the father rolling the ball to the two-year-old is not the activity itself, but the emotions that are created between the father and his child. Similarly, a husband and wife playing tennis together, if it is a genuine quality time, will focus not on the game, but on the fact that they are spending time together. What happens on the emotional level is what matters. Our spending time together in a common pursuit communicates that we care about each other, that we enjoy being with each other, that we like to do things together. Quality conversation. Like words of affirmation, the language of quality time also has many dialects. One of the most common dialects is that of quality conversation. By quality conversation, I mean sympathetic dialogue where two individuals are sharing their experiences, thoughts, feelings, and desires in a friendly, uninterrupted context. Most individuals who complain that their spouse does not talk do not mean literally that he or she never says a word. They mean that he or she seldom takes part in sympathetic dialogue. If your spouse's primary love language is quality time, such dialogue is crucial to his or her emotional sense of being loved. Quality conversation is quite different from the first love language. Words of affirmation focus on what we are saying, whereas quality conversation focuses on what we are hearing. If I am sharing my love with you by means of quality time, and we're going to spend that time in conversation, it means I will focus on drawing you out, listening sympathetically to what you have to say. I will ask questions, not in a badgering manner, but with a genuine desire to understand your thoughts, feelings, and hopes. I met Patrick when he was 43 and had been married for 17 years. I remember him because his first words were so dramatic. He sat in the leather chair in my office, and after briefly introducing himself, he leaned forward and said with great emotion, "Dr. Chapman, I have been a fool, a real fool." "What has led you to that conclusion?" I asked. "I've been married for 17 years," he said, "and my wife has left me. Now I realize what a fool I've been." I repeated my original question. "In what way have you been a fool?" My wife would come home from work and tell me about the problems in her office. I would listen to her and then tell her what I thought she should do. I always gave her advice. I told her she had to confront the problem. Problems don't go away. You have to talk with the people involved or your supervisor. You have to deal with the problems. The next day, she would come home from work and tell me about the same problems. I would ask her if she did what I'd suggested the day before. She would shake her head and say no. So I'd repeat my advice. I told her that was the way to deal with the situation. She would come home the next day and tell me about the same problems. And again, I would ask her if she had done what I had suggested. She would shake her head and say no. After 3 or 4 nights of that, I would get angry. I would tell her not to expect any sympathy from me if she wasn't willing to take the advice I was giving her. She didn't have to live under that kind of stress and pressure. She could solve the problem if she would simply do what I told her. It hurt me to see her living under such stress because I knew she didn't have to. The next time she'd bring up the problem, I would say, "I don't want to hear about it. I've told you what you need to do. If you're not going to listen to my advice, I don't want to hear it." I would withdraw and go about my business. Now I realize that she did not want advice when she told me about her struggles at work. She wanted sympathy. She wanted me to listen, to give her attention, to let her know that I could understand the hurt, the stress, the pressure. She wanted to know that I loved her and that I was with her. She didn't want advice. She just wanted to know that I understood. But I never tried to understand. I was too busy giving advice, and now she's gone. "Why can't you see these things when you're going through them?" he asked. "I was blind to what was going on. Only now do I understand how I failed her." Patrick's wife had been pleading for quality conversation. Emotionally, she longed for him to focus attention on her by listening to her pain and frustration. Patrick was not focusing on listening, but on speaking. He listened only long enough to hear the problem and formulate a solution. He didn't listen long enough or well enough to hear her cry for support and understanding. Many of us are like Patrick. We are trained to analyze problems and create solutions. We forget that marriage is a relationship, not a project to be completed or a problem to be solved. A relationship calls for sympathetic listening with a view to understanding the other person's thoughts, feelings, and desires. We must be willing to give advice, but only when it is requested, and never in a condescending manner. Most of us have little training in listening. We are far more efficient in thinking and speaking. Learning to listen may be as difficult as learning a foreign language, but learn we must if we want to communicate love. That is especially true if your spouse's primary love language is quality time, and his or her dialect is quality conversation. Fortunately, numerous books and articles have been written on developing the art of listening. I will not seek to repeat what is written elsewhere, but suggest the following summary of practical tips. Number one, maintain eye contact when your spouse is talking. That keeps your mind from wandering and communicates that he or she has your full attention. Number two, don't listen to your spouse and do something else at the same time. Remember, quality time is giving someone your undivided attention. If you're doing something you cannot turn from immediately, tell your spouse the truth. A positive approach might be, "I know you're trying to talk to me and I'm interested, but I want to give you my full attention. I can't do that right now, but if you will give me 10 minutes to finish this, I'll sit down and listen to you." Most spouses will respect such a request. Number three, listen for feelings. Ask yourself, what emotion is my spouse experiencing? When you think you have the answer, confirm it. For example, "It sounds to me like you're feeling disappointed because I forgot..." That gives him the chance to clarify his feelings. It also communicates that you are listening intently to what he is saying. Number four, observe body language. Clenched fist, trembling hands, tears, furrowed brows, and eye movement may give you clues as to what the other is feeling. Sometimes body language speaks one message while words speak another. Ask for clarification to make sure you know what she is really thinking and feeling. Number five, refuse to interrupt. Recent research has indicated that the average individual listens only 17 seconds before interrupting and interjecting their own ideas. If I give you my undivided attention while you're talking, I will refrain from defending myself or hurling accusations at you or dogmatically stating my position. My goal is to discover your thoughts and feelings. My objective is not to defend myself or to set you straight. It is to understand you. Learning to talk. Quality conversation requires not only sympathetic listening, but also self-revelation. When a wife says, "I wish my husband would talk. I never know what he's thinking or feeling," she is pleading for intimacy. She wants to feel close to her husband. But how can she feel close to someone whom she doesn't know? In order for her to feel loved, he must learn to reveal himself. If her primary love language is quality time, and her dialect is quality conversation, her emotional love tank will never be filled until he tells her his thoughts and feelings. Self-revelation does not come easy for some of us. Many adults grew up in homes where the expression of thoughts and feelings was not encouraged, but condemned. To request a toy was to receive a lecture on the sad state of family finances. The child went away feeling guilty for having the desire, and he quickly learned not to express his desires. When he expressed anger, the parents responded with harsh and condemning words. Thus, the child learned that expressing angry feelings is not appropriate. If the child was made to feel guilty for expressing disappointment at not being able to go to the store with his father, he learned to hold his disappointment inside. By the time we reach adulthood, many of us have learned to deny our feelings. We are no longer in touch with our emotional selves. A wife says to her husband, How did you feel about what Steve did? And the husband responds, I think he was wrong. He should have. But he is not telling her his feelings. He is voicing his thoughts. Perhaps he has reason to feel angry, hurt, or disappointed, but he has lived so long in the world of thought that he does not acknowledge his feelings. When he decides to learn the language of quality conversation, it will be like learning a foreign language. The place to begin is by getting in touch with his feelings, becoming aware that he is an emotional creature in spite of the fact that he has denied that part of his life. If you need to learn the language of quality conversation, begin by noting the emotions you feel away from home. Carry a small notepad and keep it with you daily. 3 times each day, ask yourself, what emotions have I felt in the last 3 hours? What did I feel on the way to work when the driver behind me was riding my bumper? What did I feel when I stopped at the gas station and the automatic pump did not shut off and the side of the car was covered in gas? What did I feel when I got to the office and found that the project I was working on had to be completed in 3 days when I thought I had another 2 weeks? Write down your feelings in the notepad and a word or two to help you remember the event corresponding to the feeling. Your list may look something like this. Event, tailgater. Feelings, angry. Event, gas station. Feelings, very upset. Event, work project due in 3 days. Feelings, frustrated and anxious. Do that exercise 3 times a day, and you will develop an awareness of your emotional nature. Using your notepad, communicate your emotions and the events briefly with your spouse as many days as possible. In a few weeks, you will become comfortable expressing your emotions with him or her. And eventually, you will feel comfortable discussing your emotions toward your spouse, the children, and events that occur within the home. Remember, emotions themselves are neither good nor bad. They are simply our psychological responses to the events of life. Based on our thoughts and emotions, we eventually make decisions. When the tailgater was following you on the highway and you felt angry, perhaps you had these thoughts. I wish he would lay off. I wish he would pass me. If I thought I wouldn't get caught, I'd press the accelerator and leave him in the twilight. I should slam on my brakes and let his insurance company buy me a new car. Maybe I'll pull off the road and let him pass. Eventually, you made some decision, or the other driver backed off, turned, or passed you, and you arrived safely at work. In each of life's events, we have emotions, thoughts, desires, and eventually, actions. It is the expression of that process that we call self-revelation. If you choose to learn the love dialect of quality conversation, that is the learning road you must follow. Dead seas and babbling brooks. Not all of us are out of touch with our emotions, but when it comes to talking, all of us are affected by our personality. I have observed 2 basic personality types. The first I call the Dead Sea. In the little nation of Israel, the Sea of Galilee flows south by way of the Jordan River into the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea goes nowhere. It receives, but it does not give. This personality type receives many experiences, emotions, and thoughts throughout the day. They have a large reservoir where they store that information, and they are perfectly happy not to talk. If you say to a Dead Sea personality, "What's wrong? Why aren't you talking tonight?" he will probably answer, "Nothing's wrong. What makes you think something's wrong?" And that response is perfectly honest. He is content not to talk. He could drive from Chicago to Detroit and never say a word and be perfectly happy. On the other extreme is the babbling brook. For this personality, whatever enters into the eye gate or the ear gate comes out the mouth gate, and there are seldom 60 seconds between the two. Whatever they see, whatever they hear, they tell. In fact, if no one is at home to talk to, they will call someone else. Do you know what I saw? Do you know what I heard? If they can't get someone on the telephone, they may talk to themselves because they have no reservoir. Many times, a Dead Sea marries a babbling brook. That happens because when they are dating, it is a very attractive match. If you are a Dead Sea and you date a babbling brook, you will have a wonderful evening. You don't have to think, "How will I get the conversation started tonight? How will I keep the conversation flowing?" In fact, you don't have to think at all. All you have to do is nod your head and say, uh-huh, and she will fill up the whole evening, and you will go home saying, what a wonderful person. On the other hand, if you are a babbling brook and you date a dead sea, you will have an equally wonderful evening, because dead seas are the world's best listeners. You will babble for 3 hours, he will listen intently to you, and you will go home saying, what a wonderful person. You attract each other. But 5 years after marriage, the babbling brook wakes up one morning and says, we've been married 5 years, and I don't know him. The Dead Sea is saying, I know her too well. I wish she would stop the flow and give me a break. The good news is that dead seas can learn to talk, and babbling brooks can learn to listen. We are influenced by our personality, but we are not controlled by it. One way to learn new patterns is to establish a daily sharing time in which each of you will talk about 3 things that happened to you that day and how you feel about them. I call that the minimum daily requirement for a healthy marriage. If you will start with the daily minimum, in a few weeks or months, you may find quality conversation flowing more freely between you. Quality activities. In addition to the basic love language of quality time, or giving your spouse your undivided attention, there's another dialect called quality activities. At a recent marriage seminar, I asked couples to complete the following sentence. I feel most loved by my husband or wife when... Here is the response of a 29-year-old husband who has been married for 8 years. I feel most loved by my wife when we do things together. Things I like to do and things she likes to do. We talk more. It sort of feels like we're dating again. That is a typical response of individuals whose primary love language is quality time. The emphasis is on being together, doing things together, giving each other undivided attention. Quality activities may include anything in which one or both of you have an interest. The emphasis is not on what you're doing, but on why you're doing it. The purpose is to experience something together, to walk away from it feeling, he cares about me. He was willing to do something with me that I enjoy, and he did it with a positive attitude. That is love, and for some people, it is love's loudest voice. One of Emily's favorite pastimes is browsing in bookshops, from sprawling superstores to hole-in-the-wall used book dealers. Her husband Jeff, less of an avid reader, has learned to share these experiences with Emily and even point out books she may enjoy. Emily, for her part, has learned to compromise and not force Jeff to spend hours in the stacks. As a result, Jeff proudly says, I vowed early on that if there was a book Emily wanted, I would buy it for her. Jeff may never become a bookworm, but he has become proficient at loving Emily. Quality activities may include such things as putting in a garden, visiting historic neighborhoods, shopping for antiques, going to a concert, taking long walks, or having another couple over for soup and bread. The activities are limited only by your interest and willingness to try new experiences. The essential ingredients in a quality activity are 1. At least one of you wants to do it. 2. The other is willing to do it. And 3. Both of you know why you're doing it, to express love by being together. One of the byproducts of quality activities is that they provide a memory bank from which to draw in the years ahead. Fortunate is the couple who remembers an early morning stroll along the coast, the spring they planted the flower garden, the time they got poison ivy chasing a rabbit through the woods, the night they attended their first Major League Baseball game together, the one and only time they went skiing together and he broke his leg, the amusement parks, the concerts, the cathedrals, and oh yes, the awe of standing beneath the waterfall after the 2-mile hike. They can almost feel the mist as they remember. Those are memories of love, especially for the person whose primary love language is quality time. And where do we find time for such activities, especially if both of us have vocations outside the home? We make time, just as we make time for lunch and dinner. Why? Because it is just as essential to our marriage as meals are to our health. Is it difficult? Does it take careful planning? Yes. Does it mean we have to give up some individual activities? Perhaps. Does it mean we do some things we don't particularly enjoy, Certainly. Is it worth it? Without a doubt. What's in it for me? The pleasure of living with a spouse who feels loved and knowing that I have learned to speak his or her love language fluently. A personal word of thanks to Bill and Betty Jo in Little Rock, who taught me the value of love language number one, words of affirmation, and love language number two, quality time. Now it's on to Chicago and love language number three. Your turn. What in your marriage detracts from spending quality time? If your spouse's love language is quality time, let me give some suggestions. Number one, take a walk together through the old neighborhood where one of you grew up. Ask questions about your spouse's childhood. Ask, what are the fun memories of your childhood? Then, what was most painful about your childhood? Number two, go to the city park and rent bicycles. Ride until you're tired, then sit and watch the ducks. When you get tired of the quacks, roll on to the rose garden. Learn each other's favorite color of rose and why. Number three, ask your spouse for a list of five activities that he would enjoy doing with you. Make plans to do one of them each month for the next 5 months. If money is a problem, space the freebies between the "we can't afford this" events. Number four, ask your spouse where she most enjoys sitting when talking with you. The next week, text her one afternoon and say, "I want to make a date with you one evening this week and sit on the porch and talk. Which night and what time would be best for you?" Number five, think of an activity your spouse enjoys, but which brings little pleasure to you. NASCAR? Browsing the flea markets? Working out? Tell your spouse that you are trying to broaden your horizons and would like to join him in this activity sometime this month. Set a date and give it your best effort. Number six, plan a weekend getaway just for the two of you sometime within the next 6 months. Be sure it is a weekend when you won't have to call the office or have a commitment with your kids. Focus on relaxing together, doing what one or both of you enjoy. Number seven, make time every day to share with each other some of the events of the day. When you spend more time on Facebook than you do listening to each other, you can end up more concerned about your 100 friends than about your spouse. Number eight, have a "let's review our history" evening once every 3 months. Set aside an hour to focus on your history. Select five questions each of you will answer, such as, who was your best or worst teacher in school and why? When did you feel your parents were proud of you? What is the worst mistake your mother ever made? What is the worst mistake your father ever made? What do you remember about the religious aspect of your childhood? Each evening, agree on your five questions before you begin your sharing. At the end of the five questions, stop and decide on the five questions you will ask next time. Number nine, camp out in the living room. Spread your blankets and pillows on the floor. Get your Pepsi and popcorn, pretend the TV is broken, and talk like you used to when you were dating. Talk till the sun comes up or something else happens. If the floor gets too hard, go back upstairs and go to bed. You won't forget this evening. Chapter 6, Love Language Number 3, Receiving Gifts. I was in Chicago when I studied anthropology. By means of detailed ethnographies, that is, printed descriptions of a particular culture, I visited fascinating peoples all over the world. I went to Central America and studied the advanced culture of the Mayans and the Aztec. I crossed the Pacific and studied the tribal peoples of Melanesia, Polynesia. I studied the Eskimos of the northern tundra and the aboriginal Ainus of Japan. I examined the cultural patterns surrounding love and marriage and found that in every culture I studied, gift-giving was a part of the love-marriage process. Anthropologists are intrigued by cultural patterns that tend to pervade cultures, and so was I. Could it be that gift-giving is a fundamental expression of love that transcends cultural barriers? Is the attitude of love always accompanied by the concept of giving? Those are academic and somewhat philosophical questions, but if the answer is yes, it has profound practical implications for North American couples. Juice for you. I took an anthropology field trip to the island of Dominica, Our purpose was to study the culture of the Carib Indians, and on the trip, I met Fred. Fred was not a Carib, but a young black man of 28 years. Fred had lost a hand in a fishing by dynamite accident, and since the accident, he could not continue his fishing career. He had plenty of available time, and I welcomed his companionship. We spent hours talking about his culture. Upon my first visit to Fred's house, he said to me, "Mr. Gary, would you like to have some juice?" To which I responded enthusiastically. He turned to his younger brother and said, "Go get Mr. Gary some juice." His brother turned, walked down the dirt path, climbed a coconut tree, and returned with a green coconut. "Open it," Fred commanded. With three swift movements of the machete, his brother uncorked the coconut, leaving a triangular hole at the top. Fred handed me the coconut and said, "Juice for you." It was green, but I drank it, all of it, because I knew it was a gift of love. I was his friend, and to friends you give juice. At the end of our weeks together, as I prepared to leave that small island, Fred gave me a final token of his love. It was a crooked stick, 14 inches in length, that he had taken from the ocean. It was silky smooth from pounding against the rocks. Fred said that the stick had lived on the shores of Dominica for a long time, and he wanted me to have it as a reminder of the beautiful island. Even today, when I look at that stick, I can almost hear the sound of the Caribbean waves, but it is not as much a reminder of Dominica as it is a reminder of love. A gift is something you can hold in your hand and say, "Look, he was thinking of me," or "she remembered me." You must be thinking of someone to give him a gift. The gift itself is a symbol of that thought. It doesn't matter whether it costs money. What is important is that you thought of him. And it is not the thought implanted only in the mind that counts, but the thought expressed in actually securing the gift and giving it as an expression of love. Mothers remember the days their children bring a flower from the yard as a gift. They feel loved, even if it was a flower they didn't want picked. From early years, children are inclined to give gifts to their parents, which may be another indication that gift-giving is fundamental to love. Gifts are visual symbols of love. Most wedding ceremonies include the giving and receiving of rings. The person performing the ceremony says, "These rings are outward and visible signs of an inward and spiritual bond that unites your two hearts in love that has no end." That is not meaningless rhetoric. It is verbalizing a significant truth. Symbols have emotional value. Perhaps that is even more graphically displayed near the end of a disintegrating marriage, when the husband or wife stops wearing the wedding ring. It is a visual sign that the marriage is in serious trouble. One husband said, "When she threw her wedding rings at me and angrily walked out of the house, slamming the door behind her, I knew our marriage was in serious trouble. I didn't pick up her rings for 2 days. When I finally did, I cried." The rings were a symbol of what should have been, but lying in his hand and not on her finger, they were visible reminders that the marriage was falling apart. The lonely rings stirred deep emotions within the husband. Visual symbols of love are more important to some people than to others. That's why individuals have different attitudes toward wedding rings. Some never take the ring off after the wedding. Others don't even wear a wedding band. That is another sign that people have different primary love languages. If receiving gifts is my primary love language, I will place great value on the ring you have given me, and I will wear it with great pride. I will also be greatly moved emotionally by other gifts that you give through the years. I will see them as expressions of love. Without gifts as visual symbols, I may question your love. Gifts come in all sizes, colors, and shapes. Some are expensive, and others are free. To the individual whose primary love language is receiving gifts, the cost of the gift will matter little, unless it is greatly out of line with what you can afford. If a millionaire gives only $1 gifts regularly, the spouse may question whether that is an expression of love. But when family finances are limited, a $1 gift may speak $1 million worth of love. Gifts may be purchased, found, or made. The husband who finds an interesting bird feather while out jogging and brings it home to his wife has found himself an expression of love, unless, of course, his wife is allergic to feathers. For the man who can afford it, you can purchase a beautiful card for less than $5. For the man who cannot, you can make one for free. Get the paper out of the trash can where you work. Fold it in the middle. Take scissors and cut out a heart. Write, "I love you," and sign your name. Gifts need not be expensive. But what of the person who says, "I'm not a gift giver. I didn't receive many gifts growing up. I never learned how to select gifts. It doesn't come naturally for me." Congratulations. You have just made the first discovery in becoming a great lover. You and your spouse speak different love languages. Now that you've made that discovery, get on with the business of learning your second language. If your spouse's primary love language is receiving gifts, you can become a proficient gift giver. In fact, it is one of the easiest languages to learn. Where do you begin? Make a list of all the gifts your spouse has expressed excitement about receiving through the years. They may be gifts you have given or gifts given by other family members or friends. The list will give you an idea of the kind of gifts your spouse will enjoy receiving. If you have little or no knowledge about selecting the kind of gifts on your list, recruit the help of family members who know your spouse. In the meantime, select gifts that you feel comfortable purchasing, making,